Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to A Celtic State of Mind. I'm Paul John Dykes, and I'm delighted to be joined once again by my cohort, Kevin Graham, for another episode of Scream A Celica. Kevin, welcome back to A Celtic State of Mind.
Thank you very much, Paul. It's great to be back on this, especially on a weekly basis now, during this strange time that we're living in.
It is a strange time, and I was just explaining before we went on air there, Kevin, that the way that I'm getting through it is by having the structure of a daily podcast. And what's come from that is us looking at the different types of articles we were doing for the website and looking to see which ones could have been adapted into regular feature podcasts. The obvious one with Scream A Celica, and I really enjoy every episode where you might text me a day or two before just to say this is the album we're doing, and then obviously it's a case of having a look back at what Celtic were doing around about that time. So we've had some great discussions around Lost Souls by Doves, Unfinished Monkey Business by Ian Brown, Suede's coming up, and since the Suede episode, I've got to admit, Kevin, that you kind of reignited my interest in the band, and I started listening to them again, downloaded a B-sides album on the say-so of somebody who commented on Twitter. So it does that thing to you where you backtrack, doesn't it?
Definitely. I did listen to the Nick Cave track that you sent me, and brilliant. Wow, just wow. I'll need to make time to dive into his back catalogue. I don't think he's the sort of artist that would be able to listen to just in the background as I'm sorting the Wayne's dinner or something like that. I think I really need to sit in a darkened room, headphones on, and immerse myself in Mr. Cave.
Oh yes, it definitely deserves some investment in his back catalogue. I think I text you that particular song, not to sound morbid, but it'd be my funeral song. You know, it's just incredible. It's like a hymn. Brilliant. So yeah, make sure you do that. Make sure you delve in. This week, we are looking at music that I don't think would be suitable for funeral music, or perhaps it would. What is the band and the LP that we'll be looking at this week, Kevin?
The band this week are Mogwai, and the album is Hardcore Will Never Die, But You Will. What a great title.
Great title. Brilliant title. 2011, we're going back to Valentine's Day 2011.
The story behind this album with myself is basically I knew who Mogwai were, but I can't say that I ever got into them when they first came out in 97, 98. I knew the tracks like Mogwai Fear Satan and New Paths to Helicon Part 1. But this album sort of came out at a time where I'd sort of detached myself from music. I think guys always detach themselves sometimes from what defined them previously when they get married, have a kid, and other priorities start taking over. And there was nothing about at this time which was really catching me. I think, if I remember rightly at this time, the gigs I was probably going to, I was probably going with my wife to see bands like The View and The Vaccines, bands like that. But I kind of felt like, do you know, like a photocopier, if it keeps on printing the same photocopy and it runs out of ink, and eventually the photocopy will fade, the picture will fade and fade. I felt a bit like that around about this point, and I started listening to the Twilight Sad's album, Forget the Night Ahead, and the Twilight Sad played in the Tollbooth in October 2010 with Errors, and I went to see them, and I was blown away with them. So when I started looking more into the Twilight Sad, obviously, Mogwai's name kept on coming up quite a bit. So Mogwai were playing the Tollbooth in Stirling in January 2011, and it was to promote this album, and I went to see them, and I wanted to be challenged. I mentioned just earlier on that sometimes you've got to immerse yourself, sometimes you've got to let yourself get taken by something, and they definitely done it that night. It was great. And they played virtually the whole Hardcore Will Never Die But You Will, and I loved it. I really did love it. And from that point, that album came out about a month later. I bought the album and I listened to it non-stop, along with dipping in and out of their back catalogue. What I would probably say is the reason that I never got investigated them before was maybe it was a bit hard work for me, and the stuff that I was maybe listening to was more accessible, and I like lyrics, and I maybe didn't believe in the power of instrumental music that wasn't electronic. But my opinion has went full circle on that now. Some of the songs on that album are really euphoric, there's some of them that are really riff heavy, but all of them have got melody lines which build up, worm their way into your head, and you can feel yourself, you can actually be humming them for days, which is maybe not what they were actually going for, but it does actually work like that for me anyway. The first song on the album, White Noise, it's got that sort of offbeat. It's like sounds slightly out of time, but also sounds full of hope. Then you've got like the Kraut Rock, a Mexican Grand Prix, then the full out riff, almost Led Zeppelin, Rano Pano. Then, I mean, he ended an album with a song called Your Lionel Richie. It's just brilliant. And even like their song titles, we mentioned the album title, but there's a song on Hardcore Will Never Die But You Will called George Square Thatcher Death Party, which, letters to the metro.
I wanted an invite to that party. And, you know, when you see that, you think to yourself, right, even if I hadn't heard of the band by then, I would have been a fan. I would have sought out the album, that's for sure, Kevin. This is an album that I didn't realise they had played the Tollbooth early doors in 2011. That's obviously where you and I were regularly recording A Celtic State of Mind up until the lockdown. That would have been an incredible gig that night, I'm sure.
It was. I mean, I believe that there was only 150 tickets, maybe. It was powerful. As powerful as what you can get in that sort of small venue, eh? And it was a bit like when I did see the Twilight Sad there. The Twilight Sad were quite noisy and quite challenging as well. And I was like, wait a minute, there's something here. There's something that I've dismissed before that I need to go back and check out. And I'm extremely glad that I did go back and check it out. Mogwai are now one of my favourite bands. I'm currently trying to write under the lockdown, but I've got a 2-year-old who's getting to the absolute mentalist stage, and it's becoming extremely difficult. But I love listening to Mogwai when I'm trying to write. It's so emotional. Yeah. There's a structure. Even if I'm writing like spoken word bits, Mogwai songs have got a structure, and sometimes I try to work poems to Mogwai structures. not to sound like Mogwai, not to actually recite across Mogwai songs, but I try to get the feeling, the depth of emotion that sometimes that Mogwai can get. So yeah, I've also got an idea in my head that I'm going to write a book of poetry just using Mogwai song titles. I've actually scribbled down a couple of ideas of how I would do it, so that maybe see the light of day at one point.
I do like the concept. I do remember reading an article once where Ian Brown spoke about writing lyrics to the backward tracks, so they would have an instrumental or even a song they'd already recorded, and when they played it backwards, he heard melodies coming out of the backward track, mm-hmm. and he would write songs and melodies around that. So I do like the concept of utilising or using the influence of other existing art to create something new.
They've got me into like soundtracks, they've got me into like the new classical stuff like Nils Fram, Erland Cooper, guys like that. Really, but again, it's music for me now. You have to really give it time because it's precious. And if you've got a busy life, you can't really throw it away. You can't really. There's a lot of things. If you're pottering about in the kitchen and the living room or doing stuff, there's stuff that you can put on in the background that's always going to be there and you know where you are. But some of the best stuff you need to really invest your time in, and it's worthwhile investing your time in. And I'm really glad that I invested my time that night finding this album, because I listened to this album quite a lot that year in 2011. And aye. I'm sure Stuart done an interview with might be Pitchfork, and he rated this as the third best Mogwai album. So I maybe got no a bad introduction to Mogwai.
You mentioned the song George Square Thatcher Death Party. It's up there with Scotland Shame in the pantheon of Mogwai song titles. But the way I discovered this band, and I don't make any apology for this, I discovered them through the pages of the NME back in the late 90s, Kevin. And I remember the debut album, Mogwai Young Team, because where I come from in Fife, there's a young team in every village. Now, I'm going to ask you, who's the young team in your village? What were they called?
The Young St Ninians Toll.
From where I was brought up, I don't think we were that inventive, because it was the Yob and the YVB, or the Young Oakley Boys and the Young Valleyfield Boys, right, YVB.
I'll give you the three names of the main gangs in Bannockburn in the early 90s. So you had the Young St Ninians Toll. You had the Mental Burn team, who were from Bannockburn, and you had the Hull Park Glory Boys.
I'm not sure about that last one. I don't think I would be scared to go into their territory and buy something out of their local shop. The YVB and the YOB, if anybody out there is listening that's got one of the tattoos on their neck, you know what I'm talking about. But I liked the fact that they called it Mogwai Young Team, and obviously they went on to have an album called Come On Die Young. But I got into them through the pages of the NME. The NME was a very influential newspaper to me in the 1990s, Kevin. And it's difficult now to imagine that, because obviously information is at your fingertips all the time. You had to kind of seek it out back then. And some of the cooler heads who I worked with were into Mogwai, which always helps because of the word of mouth thing. You trust somebody's musical taste if they've given you a few bands, and they'd given me things like the Beat a Band. So I trusted that. But then I remember two other things about the band. The first one was Tina Park, 1999, and the launch of the T-shirt, which was a brown T-shirt with the words Blur are shite. And that got them a lot of kind of press. I do remember, now we've spoken about Blur, and I don't think you or I think that they're shite, but it certainly got them a lot of coverage. And the quote that Stuart Braithwaite gave to the NME was, "We decided to proclaim our dislike of one of the weakest bands on the planet by putting out these shirts. We sold out in one day, and Super Furry Animals and Pavement have put in an order for more." What I would have done, and obviously I wasn't a headliner in a band at that time, I would have worn one of the T-shirts. If I was Damon Albarn, I would have taken to the stage wearing a Mogwai T-shirt. Would you know? I remember Alex James did that with Oasis, one on Top of the Pops. Is that not the greatest response to such a stunt?
I'm sure if he could have got one, he maybe would have. Or if he had, if he was that way inclined. I think, I do remember Mogwai. I mean, I was a Rogers reader at the NME, and I do remember reading about their live reviews and seeing them in the pages of the NME with Celtic tops and with Henrik Larsson scarves across their amplifiers and stuff like that. And that always kind of piqued my interest. And the first song I ever heard from them was on an NME tape. I did like it, I really did like it, but again, it's what you're kicking about doing at the time, who you're with. And if Mogwai's not really coming on, if you haven't really got that, what could I say, will, or to give it your full attention, then you're not going to. And I'm extremely glad that I waited till I was older to appreciate it, because I didn't think I would have appreciated, maybe didn't appreciate it, I probably didn't appreciate it when I was in 97, 98, 99, 2000. I probably wouldn't have appreciated it. And I'm quite glad I waited the 11 years and 7 albums deep before I actually did start appreciating what Mogwai could bring to my musical culture. And I'm extremely glad that they're now a big part of my musical diet.
And the thing is, sometimes you're just not ready for it, Kevin. As you say, you're in a different state of mind. And you mentioned the kind of Celtic connection as well. I do remember seeing the band on the front of the NME, and there was a Celtic strip underneath one of their jerseys, and I thought, I wish you had just had the picture with the Celtic top on. And then I seen the video that they did, which we've mentioned on A Celtic State of Mind before, called Dial Revenge, that was written by Stuart Braithwaite and Gruff Rhys from Super Furry Animals, and the link between the two bands, and obviously Mogwai, they're mutual friends. Mogwai, Super Furry Animals' mutual friend was Michael Brennan, who was the sound engineer, the live sound guy for both bands, and he certainly produced the Super Furry Animals album, Gorilla, and he got them together for this single, and I do remember the video.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
They got a lot of airplay on M2 as it was at the time with the Celtic scarf, and I just, straight away, you know, they've got your buy-in when they're writing songs called things like George Square, Thatcher, Death Party, Scotland's Shame, and they're bouncing about with Celtic scarves. You're always going to like that band. It's never going to be in question.
Also, the other place where I would hear Mogwai on a weekly basis was the Celtic Underground pod, because they used the Mogwai track to end with for years.
I wonder if they paid royalties for it. PRS. The PRS webcast license is pretty expensive. The Mogwai thing that they did, which was really a work of art, was the Zidane film. If you can imagine, you spoke about how Mogwai got you into soundtracks and stuff like that. Imagine a band were approached to write a soundtrack to a Zidane film. And the Zidane film is basically 90 minutes of close-ups of Zinedine Zidane, who at the time of his peak of his powers was the finest footballer on the planet. And you soundtrack that. I mean, that is just a work of art. That is cinematic.
It was on the TV a couple of years back, and I saw it on the TV. That was really before that I got into Mogwai, but I did watch it when it was on the TV, and I've seen it a couple of times since then, and it's absolutely beautiful. As you say, it's a work of art. Zidane was a work of art, and Mogwai just, they give it the texture and the depth that it requires, and it's an amazing piece of work. And again, that's probably something I wouldn't have listened to 10 years ago. And
that's the thing, because it's challenging you, and it's challenging your perception of film and music, then you are prepared to then invest in 90 minutes of a French documentary because Mogwai are involved in it.
And that's where music and football and any sort of art should actually take you. If things come too easy to you, then I think you won't remember them. But if you have to invest in stuff, and especially at these times, you have to find something worth investing in. And once you find it, it makes it all worthwhile, because our time is squeezed, even though we're in lockdown at this precise moment in time. I mean, I'm still finding hours disappearing, and I'm going, where are the actual days going? And so you still need to give yourself that little breathing space, and just, and the things that you have to invest in are the things that, that have longevity for me.
Exactly. And once you're in, you're in with a band like Mogwai. It's not something that you dip your toe in and then you just don't bother about for three albums. You know, you're in and that's you. You're not getting back out. You're into them, you know, for the rest of your musical listening days. Now, a couple of questions for you, Kevin. On the back of the Zidane movie, because the concept of that is, it's artistic, it's brilliant. It's the type of thing that's going to win awards. Just, you know, before you've even looked at it, it's got you hooked, the whole concept of it. You're looking at Zidane. I don't want you to compare a Celtic player to Zidane, but let's talk about a Celtic midfield player who played like an artist in your lifetime. Who would it be?
Paul McStay.
If there was a documentary called McStay and the 90-minute soundtrack was to be composed, who would it be composed by?
Okay, you could only go for Mogwai because of what they've done with the Zidane ones, and also because they've got a Celtic state of mind. They would get it.
It's a rhetorical question. You never know, maybe we will move into making further documentaries. But I like your answer. The second question is, we had a discussion on Twitter during the week about football teams who had kind of one-off sponsors. And I remember, for example, Cardiff City had the Super Furry Animals, and it was their logo on their jerseys. And, you know, as someone who has no interest whatsoever in Cardiff City, I would have bought that jersey because I was such a big Super Furry Animals fan. Other ones that I managed to get my hands on were things like Ian Brown, who sponsored a local team. He then had Mogwai, and Mogwai sponsored St Roch Primary School. So if a band was to sponsor Celtic, what band would that be?
Oh, I can't even go on to ask that. I can't believe that question was gone there. A band to sponsor Celtic.
And didn't he say the Wolf Tones, right?
Oh, I wasn't going to. A band to sponsor Celtic. Want to know something? Right, this is a completely rhetorical answer to this. Obviously, we can't have Mogwai because that's out of the question. And I've already answered Mogwai as one. But I would like to see Paul Heaton's name on a Celtic jersey.
That's an interesting answer. I seen a tweet that he put out where there was a big Celtic Inter Milan pennant behind him in his kitchen, and someone asked him about his kind of Celtic leanings as well.
I was more thinking along the lines of somebody that's got the right political mind, who you would like. Heaton has got the right political mind, Billy Bragg. I was thinking down that sort of route.
That's fine.
Wait a minute. Let's just scrap the last 5 minutes. Primal Scream. Get the Scream Adelica logo on the Celtic top.
I said Primal Scream on Twitter, by the way. Primal Scream.
I didn't see that sort of stuff. Aye, Primal Scream.
I'm just now wondering whether that company for Ireland that prints the god-awful Celtic T-shirts with Billy McNeil on the front of it and then a sniper on the back of it is listening to the podcast and he's maybe going to produce the Celtic strip with Primal Scream on the front. Because, believe it or not, I was doing a Q&A event with Chris Sutton and John Hartson just before lockdown, Kevin. This lady approached John and Chris for an autograph, and she was wearing one of these shirts that obviously came over from Ireland with the terrible designs, and it had the Celtic State Minds logo on it. And I just couldn't stop laughing. I think I forwarded you the picture. So I saw, charging something like 45 quid for that.
I saw one at Celtic Park this season, actually, and I had to, my cousin Scott sits next to me, so I had to hit him, and I went, Scott, have a look at that guy who's making the Tarzan noises across there. Have a look at his top that he had on, and he had one of the what you've actually described, and it had the lyrics to Something Inside So Strong on the back of it, with Neil Lennon as a sort of American Marine on the back of it.
Kevin, it's ridiculous. I mean, listen, for anybody who's listening, a Celtic State of Mind has no affiliation with the company that's printing them, whoever they are. We're not taking legal action. The only shirt that Axum appears on at the moment is the Celtic Greats, who we sponsor. And it's actually great to see Axum on the green and white hoops. But let's take it as flattery, Kevin. The Axum logo appeared on one of these shirts. It's flattery. I'm going to take that. Now, you've mentioned Neil Lennon. So Neil Lennon was in charge for his first full season at the time that this Mogwai album came out. And, you know, looking back on that particular campaign, so many high points, Kevin, but I think ultimately not winning the league really stuck with me, because it was a season where, you know, up to a certain point, you thought Neil Lennon's going to win this. And I want to just talk to you about the moments of that season, because it was about so much more. Neil Lennon takes over from Tony Mowbray near the end of the previous season. This is his first full season in charge. There's a complete makeover required because of the poor state that team was in when he took over them. He managed during that period, obviously, at the end of the previous season, there was the Ross County debacle. And many were doubting whether or not he should have got the manager's job. At the time, as I am now, I was in the Neil Lennon camp. We didn't do a podcast back then, but if you and I were discussing it at the time, I was all for Neil Lennon taking on the job, and he did. So let's have a wee chat about his first season in charge. I do remember, just as a point, Ross County, if you check the stats or the fixtures, back then were playing Dunfermline the week before the game against Celtic in the Scottish Cup. Neil Lennon was at East End Park, because I seen him in the main stand, and he left at half-time. He'd seen enough, and obviously Ross County went out and done what they'd done. So the next season, there was a complete makeover required on that side. It was a lot more to do with attitude than anything else, I think. And he did instil that in the Celtic side. Some of the high points for me, the birth of the Bruni would be a massive high point for me. You know, I spoke to Declan last week about Scott Brown's impact over the treble-treble era. And we spoke about how it was a difficult start. At that moment where he scored that goal and turned round to El Hadji Diouf, I think at that particular moment, the whole Celtic support was behind him.
That season was definitely the season where he became a major player with Celtic, and a lot of that's probably going down to Neil Lennon. What you mentioned the Ross County game, and I remember Neil Lennon's reaction to the Ross County game probably got him the job, because he was fuming. He was absolutely incredulous with rage after that game, and he says he actually spoke like a fan after that game. And okay, it was a risk you're talking about. I think he would have been 38, 39 at the time. He had never managed before, and I think we saw that in the period August to December that season. I mean, you remember we got put out with Braga in the Champions League, and then we got absolutely hammered off Utrecht in the Europa League playoff as well. So we had no European football. It was a time as well where the attendances in Scottish football were terrible. I remember going to games at Celtic Park at that time, and it was near empty. Well, not near empty, but you know what I mean. There was more green seats and bodies that were actually there. And for the first few months of that season, from August to December, we looked completely disjointed. And we looked like a team that had been cobbled together in that summer and had a rookie manager in charge and a rookie backroom staff. And I know yourself, you've spoke to some of the backroom staff at that time. And I think a lot of the time they were flying by the seat of their pants. And there was stuff that happened in the changing room which wasn't for the best for the team. And as Neil Lennon, Alan Thompson, Johan Mialbi found their feet as managers and assistant managers respectively. But do you remember that December, Paul? It was absolutely freezing. Absolutely.
There was call-offs. I'm thinking back to that season, Kevin. There was so much going on, so much off the field that was going on. And, you know, you do, when you think about Lenny's first season, there's certain games. I mean, I mentioned the 2-2 game at Ibrox when Brown scored, but there's other points of that season that we need to kind of mention, and they were just disjointed, because you could look at, if you go back to the November before there was a couple of weeks with no football, when you go back to the November, Kevin, when we absolutely trounced Mark McGee's Aberdeen 9-0, and you watched Celtic that day and you thought to yourself, this is a team, you know, the disjointed nature that you're talking about, and which reared its ugly head throughout the season. When it clicked and when it worked so well. I remember looking at that and thinking to myself, how many goals is Gary Hooper actually going to score? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the 9-0 game, we're going to mention the Inverness game in a moment, where we realised that obviously we'd thrown it away nearer the end of the season. But the Inverness side, that was a side that we completely pumped 6-0 in the cup that season. But the one game that you tend to forget about is the 2-each game at Celtic Park where we were 2-0 up against Inverness.
Mm-hmm.
So that was in the wake of the scandal of the, obviously, the referees telling lies and, you know, the big cover-up. And what followed that, it was the Hugh Dallas scandal.
Scandal,
the, you know, the head of the referees is basically sending inappropriate emails in relation to the Pope and child abuse, etc. And that was a man who was the head of referees, and that was all happening at the same time, and Celtic fans constantly being cried paranoid. But this actually happened, and the events of the Dundee United game where there was a cover-up.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You know, and it's not paranoia, it was factual. And that was all going in the background. But the 2-2 game at Celtic Park against Inverness, Cali Thistle, was a game that when you look at it, Kevin, we, you know, that was 2 points dropped when we were 2-0 up. And obviously the game that we'll go on to talk about is the one that you remember up at Inverness when Neil Lennon's kicking the water bottles because he realises we've chucked the league.
Aye, the Inverness, I remember the 2-each game at Celtic Park. I also remember Lennon went into the New Year derby game basically under severe pressure. He had failed to win any big game. We were behind in the league, albeit we had games in hand. But there was real rumours at that point. If he would have went to Ibrox and lost, then he probably wouldn't have been in a job for much longer. So we went to Ibrox and won 2-0. Then we kicked on from there. And as soon as we kicked on, there was a mirror held up to Scottish society who didn't want Neil Lennon to be successful. And the chaos started happening. And that period, it probably started happening before that. You mentioned the Dundee United. But as soon as we started putting a 1-1 together, and it looked like, by the way, we could be genuine title contenders. By the way, we could actually be genuine treble winners, because when you look back, did we throw away a treble that season? Could well say that we did. The nonsense started, and nobody comes out the nonsense well. The SFA don't come out the nonsense well. Any time that Celtic took them on that season, Celtic bet them. They seem to know the rules better than the SFA. The Scottish press didn't come out it very well. They probably caused the majority of hassle that Neil Lennon got by the way he was portrayed in the press. The Scottish Government, the SNP, didn't come out at well because of their botched handling of the shame game where three Rangers players were sent off. They caused their army on the touchline and only Neil Lennon got charged for it. And most of all, Scottish society didn't come out it very well because they just seemed to shrug their shoulders and go, he brings it on himself. And it was a really dark period for Scottish football. And
it was.
And you probably the most controversial period for Scottish football for a number of decades, up until a certain club went bust and the shenanigans after that. But what you've got to look at and what people have got to look at is there's only one answer to the question why it happened. And it happened because anti-Irish, anti-Catholic racism. That's it. Bottom line.
Yes.
And Scotland didn't cover itself in glory. We've got to have a look at what happened. If somebody would have told me, this shows you how your memory plays tricks on you. I really did think that when Lennon was attacked at Tynecastle, it was at the following season. I didn't think it was in the running of this season until I checked back. When you have a look at it, before the game we bet them 3-0 at Celtic Park after the Brunei was born.
Yep.
There was a package intercepted with bullets. Then there was a viable device intercepted. Then there seemed to be something in the papers every single day. And it was as if we had been transported back to Belfast in the 1970s. And you've got wallopers in the press who are blaming Neil Lennon for these absolute idiots sending them bullets and bombs. And you're going, wait a minute, this is no right. Do you remember the last game of that season when we lost the league? And
yes.
Celtic Park was absolutely jumping. absolutely jumping that day. And Neil Lennon wanted to bring the Thunder back, eh? And definitely Celtic Park that day was absolutely rocking. But there's two ways you can look at this. And I was thinking about this earlier on. There's two ways we can look at this season. Neil Lennon was struggling in December, and we went on a great run. So there's two trains of thought here. I've said that it could be claimed that we blew a treble by the game in Inverness that you already mentioned, and also the League Cup final where we just didn't turn up. Just didn't turn up that game at all. So we ended up winning the Scottish Cup. We chucked away the league. We had an 8-point lead at one point in the league, even though Rangers had two games in hand. We threw that away. So the question, there's two questions that the Celtic support need to ask themselves. Did Neil Lennon get another season because of what happened off the field? Or did Neil Lennon get another season because we believed in his abilities as a football manager to turn that team into a championship winning side? And it's a difficult question to answer because there's merits in both arguments.
You know there is, and what you've mentioned there, talking about the off-the-field issues that Neil Lennon more than anyone faced, but obviously Paddy McCourt and Niall McGinn also received threats through the post. In fact, there were parcels intercepted that were due to be sent to both McGinn and Paddy McCourt, and McCourt uttered the immortal line to me when I asked him about it. Were you worried, Paddy? Were you worried about when Celtic pulled you in and the head of the police was there to tell you about the threat to your life? And he says, no, because where I'm from, you didn't get warned. That really just brought it home to me. But you're absolutely right. You're looking at the backdrop of cover-ups within the refereeing fraternity, Kevin, and that was proven that there was a cover-up. And you then look at a couple of the results in that season that had Celtic won them, and we should have, then the Inverness game up at Inverness no longer is a pivotal match. I've already mentioned the game as a team. We threw away the 2-0 lead. No one else to blame there. But I remember playing at Hamilton and scoring a last-minute goal. It was a perfectly good goal, and it was chopped off by Willie Collum, and we ended up drawing that game 1-1. So there's two draws. We proved, like you say, we proved against Rangers that we were a better side. You know, the Samaras game at the New Year, we obliterated them 3-0 in between the two cup games. And then there was the now referred to as the shame game. You know, it wasn't the shame game in terms of Neil Lennon and Celtic. You know, there was only one club who had a number of red cards after the final whistle, and it wasn't Celtic. That was an excuse, and I've mentioned this and I've written about it. That was an excuse for the legislation to be introduced. It was a complete smoke and mirror situation whereby everybody knew that Rangers were going down the Swanee. Now, those in the highest echelons, now, when you're talking about the highest echelons of Scottish society in relation to Celtic and Rangers, a full house at Celtic Park or a full house at Ibrox is worth £1 million to the Scottish economy. So this is something that the government is interested in, they've got vested interest in it, and so do the police, because it's worth a lot of money to the police to police the two big Glasgow clubs. Now, there was discussions leading up to this particular season where there was a possibility of looking at non-policed games, you know, categorising the games so that it could be looked after by stewards that would be employed by the clubs. So if Rangers were to have gone bust, which we know they eventually did, Kevin, and the writing was on the wall, the Scottish Police are looking at half of their policing budget for football events in Scotland disappearing overnight. So the only way they can actually rectify that is to justify their own existence at the games, and that's why the legislation was introduced. That wasn't something that was brought on by Neil Lennon and Ally McCoy's falling out on the sidelines. But Neil Lennon was the guy who was the scapegoat. And that a big part of that was down to the media perception that was portrayed in the media of Neil Lennon. What then happens is that builds up people into a frenzy, and they think it's okay. They think it's okay to run down a stand at Tynecastle, jump over the boards and attack them on the sideline in a live football game. Or people actually think it's acceptable to attack them in the street or send something through the post. So I think near the end of that season, particularly after the attack at Tynecastle, when Lennon took the field, Kevin, and we knew that we'd probably thrown away the league, and he uttered the now immortal words.
This is not the end. This is just the beginning.
This is just the beginning. And the Celtic fans, to a man in the stadium that day, were 100% behind Neil Lennon. But it is an interesting question, and I think Peter Lawwell knew that there were so many different layers to Celtic's failure to win the league that season, and it wasn't just down to Neil Lennon. Yeah, he did make some mistakes, of course he did, but you would also be looking at a few of the other aspects of that team that Lennon brought out. For example, no one could get the tune out of Samaras that Neil Lennon could get out of him. You know, he played his best football, arguably, of his career under Neil Lennon. And he showed that he could beat teams almost on his own if he was finely tuned to do so. And Lennon could get that out of him. He'd brought in Chris Commons pretty late in the season, and Commons had shown what he could do. And I think people like Peter Lowell realised that, Neil Lennon was a rookie, but, you know, that was maybe his bedding in period. And the following season, we would see the real Neil Lennon, the real Celtic. He would have also been looking, like I just said there, about the government and the police authorities, looking at the situation at Ibrox, and he would have realised, Peter Lowell and his cohorts would have realised, Kevin, that Rangers were going down to Swanee. So there would have been no point in Celtic changing their manager at that time. But all the decisions that Celtic made were right. It's now shown to have been the right choice.
That's a really good point that you make, that Celtic maybe knew that Rangers were going to be... I mean, that Rangers team that Lennon faced that season and Walter Smith's last season in management was expensively assembled with money that they had no intention of paying back.
Yeah.
So it's... As you say, it was proven to be the right decision, whatever reasons that decision was made. But I just can't help thinking that because there is still some Lennon doubters out there, whether people are looking back at that first season and are still judging Neil Lennon on that rookie season, that maiden season, and not looking at what he done after that. And I mean, it's a big job, first job in club management, to manage Celtic against a financially doped Rangers and to face what you actually did face in that season, when it looked like, to put up with what you had to put up with that season, when it looked like you had the makings of being a half decent manager and he was going to win the league. I mean, that's what it came down to. It came down to the fact that it looked like it was going to be success. This wee guy standing on the touchline, a Northern Irish Catholic who has been not liked in Scotland from the moment that he set foot in Scotland, was going to be a success. And that's what they couldn't handle.
And it was under Neil Lennon that Rangers put themselves out of business. So Neil Lennon is someone that, you know, I'm not a sycophant for Celtic or Lennon or anybody else, but he's somebody that I think I've shown quite a bit of support for on a Celtic state of mind. And when you look back on that season, Kevin, it is a season of lost opportunities in many ways, but there was enough signs in there that he would go on to be the success that he went on to become. In terms of the music, we've already spoken about Mogwai. One thing I would mention is my brother and I, my big brother, he's 11 months older than me. So for 6 days of the year, we're the same age. And in December, what we try to do is go to a gig, and that's like our joint birthday. And that year was Mogwai at the Barras. And I think another year I bumped into you, didn't I? I was at the SEC watching Mogwai. Is that right?
Hydro. The Hydro. You bumped into me that night. I would say I was talking to the guy who designs their sleeves, Dave Thomas, mm-hmm. the Welsh guy. I've got more art of Dave Thomas in my house than he's probably got in his own studio.
Hey, listen, though, it's a good guy to know. I do remember you talking to him, and I think that was maybe 2 or 3 years ago, but 2011, I went to the Barrowlands, and it remains in my top three gigs of all time, seeing that band playing live. They were so, so powerful. But going back to what I said about my brother and I, we're the same age for 6 days every single year. So by the time that we're 62, Kevin will have been the same age for a whole year. But he'll still be a year older than me. So I can't figure that out. It's too much to take in. But other music around about that time, I remember being in love with the Bon Iver album. Is that one that you were into?
At this time, I had a quick look at the albums that were out that year, and I must admit, a lot of them bypassed me, and I say that quite a lot on this podcast. At this time, I really started diving into the Mogwai back catalogue. I was heavily listening to the Twilight Sad album, Forget the Night Ahead. I started listening to Arab Strap. We mentioned... This is when I got the Boards of Canada album as well. So music sort of this year went by me, really, apart from the Horrors album, Skyin'. I love that album. And that would have been about it. I'm sure I did probably give Noel Gallagher's first solo album a decent listen to as well, but it never really stuck with me.
What was your thoughts, or what have been your thoughts, on the Noel Gallagher solo output? Three albums he's released now, plus a series of EPs.
I must admit, his last couple of stuff's been okay. I just think that it's... When you listen to a Noel Gallagher solo album, for me, it misses a rip-roaring Liam track. and it sometimes gets a bit samey. And I've said this previously, I think the BDI albums are better than any solo stuff that Noel's put out.
I went to see BDI on both their album tours, and I still listen to both their albums. I know that you've said that they're going to be retrospectively appreciated more, and I think you're possibly right. I love their version of Sons of the Stage.
Mm-hmm.
I love their version of Sons of the Stage, which was on the Quality Street album by a band called World of Twist. And I'm pretty sure there's a chapter in my Quality Street Gang book called World of Twist, which was a plant by me. I don't know if anybody ever noticed it. No one's ever mentioned it. But I love that version. And the Noel Gallagher solo stuff, I think Dave Scott, a.k.a. R-Kid, might have mentioned that he's just kind of pining for a fully blown acoustic Noel Gallagher album, you know, writing songs just at the bare bones of acoustic tracks, the type that we used to enjoy in Oasis B-sides and all that kind of stuff, Talk Tonight, Rocking Chair, The Master Plan, which obviously had a big orchestra and all that on it. But I think that's what Noel Gallagher does best. But Noel Gallagher is looking to maybe challenge himself and challenge his listeners by going down the route of working with certain producers, etc. But the thing with Noel is, in his Oasis days, he had already scrapped an album that was produced by Richard Fearless from Death in Vegas. And then I remember when he announced this album that we are talking about, he said it was going to be a dual album and it was going to record and release an album with Amorphis Androgynous, and that was scrapped. So I think that on the one hand, he likes to challenge his listeners, but on the other hand, he doesn't want it to veer too far away from the Noel Gallagher script or the Noel Gallagher blueprint, you know, because that's two full albums that we're aware of that he scrapped with other producers. So I think I agree with Dave Scott in many ways. I wouldn't mind listening to just a stripped back acoustic album from Noel Gallagher, Kevin. But again, that's maybe because I fell in love with Oasis in 1994, perhaps, you know. But some of the other albums that came out that year, you've mentioned The Vaccines already. Arctic Monkeys, Suck It and See. You a big Arctic Monkeys fan?
Yes and no. I liked the album after Suck It and See. Suck It and See didn't really do much for me, but I really liked AM, the one after that. And I loved their last one, the Tranquility Base, Hotel and Casino. I liked those two. Again, their first album, Whatever People Say I Am, That's What I'm Not, is a great album. Again, it's got fabulous energy for a debut album, eh? But as I mentioned before, I was sort of just, nothing was sticking with me at that point. And Favourite Worst Nightmare, Humbug, then Suck It and See sort of bypassed me.
And obviously with the wonders of technology, you can always go back, Kevin. You know, it's one of the things that it's all about where you are in your kind of headspace when it comes to music for me, because I take music so seriously. You mentioned before about Mogwai, listening to Mogwai. I always listen to music when I'm working, and the Mogwai back catalogue is great for that. It doesn't interfere with what I'm doing. It's called the Mozart effect. Some people can work to music, some people can't. I definitely do. I write and everything with music in my earphones. So it's something I enjoy. Mogwai's a great band for it. But the other album I would mention, Kevin, I would give special mention to is a friend of mine called Edgar Summertime Jones, who I've mentioned time and time again. I've been writing Edgar's autobiography since 2014. So it's a wee bit longer than I've been working on the Celtic Jersey book. But Edgar is a very prolific songwriter, musician from Liverpool. He's a genius. As you know he's a genius. But a lot of the listeners may not have listened to Edgar, and he's released various albums under various different guises. The album that came out this year was called Stormy Weather. The thing with Edgar Jones is that particular band toured Europe with Oasis. Noel Gallagher was a massive fan of Edgar, and that band was, you know, right down the Led Zeppelin kind of songwriting style. So you can listen to an Edgar Summertime album and it's very, very much like relaxed, and you listen to soothing music for Stray Cats, for example, and then you listen to Stormy Weather, and it's just two different genres of music, and that's what he can do because he's so, so gifted. So that album had actually been recorded quite a few years before, but it came out in 2011. And it's one of the ones you can pick up online via Viper Records. I think you could probably download it on Amazon. But Edgar Summertime's currently working on his latest solo album, which he hopes will be out this year at some point. And we had him up, Kevin, didn't we, for an event a couple of Octobers ago up in Glasgow. And he just came up himself with his sound engineer, and he was astonishing. He was an astonishing artist, wasn't he?
He's hypnotic. He drags you in. He can do any sort of as you mentioned, Styles. He's an extremely talented musician. I mean, it was only him and an acoustic guitar, and him, an acoustic guitar and an array of pedals. And he's a genuinely nice person who had a great blether to him. He had a 1980s Evan Holdall, which I'm sure could probably have told many a story of nights with Paul Weller on tour with Oasis, stuff like that. And he just seems to be one of these guys who, will he ever get the credit that he deserves? He's also one of these magical musicians that Liverpool seems to throw up, who always just stay on the right side of the mainstream, on the wrong side of the mainstream, depending on what way you look at it. But I look forward to hearing what he's doing now. And as you say, he's got an incredible back catalogue, and anybody could ever harness that back catalogue. There's a cracking anthology in there. Absolutely fantastic anthology in there.
I know, and the thing with Edgar is he's so respected by other musicians. You look at some of the musicians that he's worked with. You know, he went on tour with Ian McCulloch of Echo and the Bunnymen before he ever released a record himself. He did have his band, The Stairs, at that time, but he got that gig through his brother Trevor, who was a sound engineer at Ian McCulloch's recording studio in Liverpool. And McCulloch was looking for a bassist, so Edgar went on tour with the Echo and the Bunnymen frontman, and he has since worked with, you know, he was the bassist of the Lars after John Power left to join or form Cast. He went on to work with Johnny Marr, Paul Weller, Saint Etienne, Ocean Colour Scene, Johnny Eccles from Love, and he's a genius. He's an absolute genius. And the album Soothing Music for Stray Cats is a masterpiece, but all his other albums are special as well. So you never know. I just think sometimes you're born in the wrong time or in the wrong era. And I think there might come a time where he's appreciated more than he is now. But anyone in Liverpool will tell you that he's a legend. So this week, Kevin, we've taken a wee walk down memory lane back to February 2011. We've spoken about Zinedine Zidane. We've spoken about Mogwai, Edgar Summertime Jones, Neil Lennon being attacked at Tynecastle. Only on Axom could you have such a variety of subjects to discuss. It's been an absolute pleasure, Kevin. And I look forward to hearing what album we'll be talking about next week on Screamer Celica.
No problem, Paul. It's been a pleasure as well. See you later.
Network.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business?
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.